Hello, it's Wayne Perry, the TV carpenter here. Can I ask you a question? Are you a DIY doer? Meaning, do you like DIY? Do you like fixing things in your home? Or does it frighten you and you'd rather somebody else did it, like your other half, or you paid somebody to come and do it? The reason I'm asking the question is, it's either one or the other. People don't realise anyone can be a DIY doer. And for me, when I say that, I don't mean the big jobs. I don't mean putting up shelves. I don't mean laying laminate flooring. For me, DIY is about having a safe house for you and your family. So when I say safe, knowing how the smoke alarm works and why does it beep, or knowing how to turn your water off if your house is flooding, or if the fuse trips and your electrics go out, knowing what all the buttons on the fuse board do. So that's a safe home. I think everyone should have that. Everyone should have a practical home, meaning everything should work as it should. So if your curtain tracks falls out the wall, you know how to put it on. Or if your toilet seat breaks, you know how to change it. But also, I think everyone should have a beautiful home, knowing what paint types to use, knowing how to upcycle some furniture. If you would like a safe, practical and beautiful home, let me teach you the DIY around it. All you need to do is join the DIY Doers Facebook group. You can find it on Facebook, or you can go to my website, thetvcarpenter.com, and I'll link you straight through to there. Let me help you create a safe, beautiful, and practical home for you and your family. On today's show, I'll be talking with Arthur Parkinson. He's an author and a gardener who's managed to create the most beautiful garden in the smallest of spaces by growing things in dolly tubs and metal bins.
I haven't actually sown a single thing yet because I know that my pots are going to be still looking nice by possibly early May. Uh-huh. So I don't sow a single seed for summer until, you know, sometimes it can be as late as the end of May. So it's about knowing when you need to start thinking about replenishing your pots. Otherwise, you do end up with, you know, a backlog of lovely-looking pots with spring bulbs in, and all your seedlings are just desperate to be planted out.
Hello and welcome to the TV Carpenter podcast. My name is Wayne Perry. This is a podcast where I inspire you to pick up the tools, have a go and create your dream home and garden, all by interviewing my friends from the world of interior design and garden makeover shows. If you have kids, you will know all about the rainbow movement. So there's been a big push for kids to draw rainbows on their front windows so that when kids are walking by, getting their, you know, 1 hour of exercise, walking around the block, they can spot all these rainbows that can lift their spirits. And we got round to painting ours this week. Me and my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter, Eva, we painted our window. We did a huge rainbow and we used Thorn Down peelable glass paint. Now, Thorn Down, as you know, are my sponsors for this podcast, and they've created this peelable glass paint that you use, you paint on like you would normally, and then when you're done with it, you literally peel it off like a face mask. And Thorn Down have been amazing, and they're giving you 15% discount on any of their online purchases. So if you want any paint from them, any wood paint, garden exterior paint or inside paint, or you want to get hold of some of this peelable glass paint, if you go on to thorndown.co.uk and put in the code TV Carpenter, you can get 15% off and it'll be sent straight to your door. I was chatting with Caroline and Ben, the owners, last year, and they were telling me about how peelable glass paint came to be. So have a little listen to this 1 minute interview and they'll explain the magic behind this peelable glass paint.
It was basically a resin supplier came to us with this peelable resin and just got us thinking about it. So we originally designed it as a greenhouse shading paint, because rather than these sort of the old ones where you have to mix up the paint together and then paint it on and it's all smeary and horrible at the end of the season, you then have to spend ages like sponging and scraping and washing it off, with this you literally roll it on And then at the end of the season, you pick at a corner and you can just peel whole sheets off. So it's a totally revolutionary paint. And when we started to talk about how it's brilliant as a greenhouse shading paint, it was then really obvious about the other uses for it. So the fact that it would be great as a conservatory shading paint as well. So that meant that we then brought on sort of colours from our wood paint joinery range onto that, so people could have the same colour skirting board as shading in their conservatory. And then, of course, there was all of the security and the privacy screening, and then all of the art and design, like art and crafts possibilities. So it did take a while to develop it because we kept on creating more and more things and more uses for it.
Something that's worth saying as well about the rainbow movement. What was really nice is the next day after me and my daughter painted this rainbow, we got a knock on the door, and it was a police lady, and she noted our rainbow, and because she said it was lovely, she dropped in a colouring book for my daughter, and it was a really lovely colouring book because inside it had a load of information about what's happening, how we should self-isolate, and how, you know, we should try and be happy and by colouring and helping mental health and things, which I thought was a really lovely thing to do. So if you get a chance and you want to do a rainbow in your window, don't forget you can get that 15% discount by going to Thorndown. So, my main event. I'm really pleased about this next interview. It's with a really lovely guy called Arthur Parkinson. He is a young gardener who had a book out, and I only discovered him because of a dear friend of mine called Yolly. She's a local florist. She has an independent florist near me, and I've done some carpentry in her shop. And sadly, she's been really ill with the virus. It's totally wiped her out to the point she had to go to hospital. But I'm pleased to say she's totally on the mend. But if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have found this guy. He's known for creating amazing flowers and plants and growing amazing cut flowers in tubs. He has a small garden, front garden up north, and you can't dig into the earth, so everything has to be grown in pots. Or he uses the old dolly tubs, which is what you used to clean clothes in back in the day, and he uses those. And if you get a chance to look on his Instagram, you'll see these flowers and garden. The plant is just insane and amazing. He keeps chickens, and he's eccentric in the most wonderful way, and I had the longest conversation with him. It was a joy to speak to him. So sit back, have a listen to Arthur Parkinson as we talk all things gardens in small spaces. Arthur Parkinson, thank you for being on the TV Carpenter podcast. I first discovered you or found out about you through a really good friend of mine, a florist called Yolly, and she'd got your book, and she said she was actually stalking you online. I was like, why are you stalking this guy? She says, you need to look up, you need to see what he does. What he does is amazing. What is it you think that that's made you a success in your world? What new angle are you working with?
It's strange to be called a success. I don't feel I am one, but I suppose what I do is quite bold with colour, and I think what people like about me is I'm being bold with colour in a space that is not a beautiful big historic garden or a huge rambling country house pile. I'm actually doing it very close by to the door, so I think people see that as a familiar thing. And they find it easy, I think, to take hopefully inspiration because they see familiarity in my space, in their space. So it's just taking, hopefully what I think I do is try and take the romance and daring aspects of a lot of large gardens that you see and try and put them into a small garden.
So describe to me the small garden. How small is it?
It's literally post stamp size, so about 16 foot long, but only by 7 foot wide. It's literally a path of pots, my garden. There's no soil to dig into. It's all a lovely brick canvas. So I'm not pretending. I think you can easily pretend that you've got a small garden. I get very annoyed when people say, oh, I've got a small garden. It turns out they've got a lawn and a shed and a greenhouse. And because to me, that's almost borderline large garden to have those aspects, whereas all I honestly have is window ledges. And I also used my nana's gardening, luckily for me, is up the road. But in terms of the home garden, it is very much tiny, rather than exaggerating.
So I've looked on your, you're known for pots and growing in these, you know, these big dolly tubs and things like that. But also you're known for your chickens and your and pollinating bees. So have you got, on your Instagram, there's this beautiful old brick built house that's got like wisteria climbing up. Is that yours or is that Nan's?
None of it's mine, really. Stupidly, I went into horticulture young, which I would not advise anyone to do, to find something that pays for. if I could talk to my, 14-year-old self, I would have said, right, you've got to, learn to pose better and be a model and try and get some money behind you. I still live at my mum's, and I look after my nan on Min, who's 94, in between working for Sarah Raven. What happened was I did start out as a full-time gardener. I went to Kew, studied at Kew, and then left Kew. House sat for Sarah, was her gardener, and then she not passed me on, but recommended me to Emma Bridgewater, who has a famous pottery in Stoke-on-Trent, and Emma was trying to create a cutting garden there because it's open to the public. So I did that for 4 years full-time, and basically that garden became my garden, treated it like my garden. So it became a seven-day-a-week job, had chickens, had two greenhouses, was producing cut flowers and vegetables, and was really building the garden up and up and up. But then what happened was I just realised I was working every day consent.
Yeah.
I was like trying to work for Sarah as well, so every holiday I'd be going down to Sussex, and then we'd have Chelsea Flower Show, so I'd be literally at Chelsea one day, then back to Stoke the other day, trying to keep the garden going and trying to manage chickens hatching out in the stock room and all crazy stuff like that. So eventually I just thought, this is not healthy and actually it's not yours. So I left last year, I think a year after I first published the book about the garden, which I'd written. And since then, I've just worked for Sarah on a freelance basis, but normally I'd be working flat out this time of year for her. So I do that, and I've also just tried to build up the garden at home to try and create an identity for me out of what I've got, realistically.
But it is amazing, like, just seeing watching your Instagram videos and watching, how you've created. I think I watched a clip where you were saying, you never go on holiday because actually you've created like a tropical garden in your garden, and it's huge. You know, these plants are huge, and it just it's so amazing. So how do you plan your these big pots and dully tubs, and talk me through your year of a planning of those.
Well, I think I've found the plants I love, and I respect anybody who embraces a plant that they love and really go for it. So I am often very much inspired by people who are growing plants, which I would never grow myself. So, in fact, last week, Joanne Lumley went to Cuba and she found a guy who'd got a fern garden. It was all ferns. Whereas I like dahlias and I like sunflowers and sweet peas and tulips. So I'm never probably going to go away from those flowers. But I'm always thinking, well, how can I make that flower look as jungle-like and exuberant as I can? Through how I'm going to grow it. So I'll never grow just one thing on its own. I'll have a crate of one particular variety of daily, so I will have grown six of them. And so it's always kind of trying to create colour, almost colour snakes through the garden, so the pots echo each other with colour.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm trying to back up the colour with lushness, so I'll think about foliage, so I'll grow grasses to just back up things. So it's not all about flowers, it's kind of like doing canopies, almost like in a rainforest type. That's my thought process anyway. I'm always thinking back to, a rainforest or, the colour chart, that kind of thing. I'm not always looking at a plant on its own. I'm thinking, how can that plant work with other things that I put with it?
Yeah.
So that's kind of my thought process. But I'm always looking, I'm lucky I've got Sarah, so often we'll go to Holland and we'll see different varieties that are up and coming. And also I think I'm not really interested in exotic planting, but I think you can't help but be inspired when you're able to walk through the palm house at 5 o'clock in the morning in July and you think, wow, this is actually what plant growth should be. It shouldn't be us dominating the plants. The plant should be dominating us. So I just try and put that back into a pot situation, really.
Yeah. Because I saw on your Instagram, which I found really interesting, that you did like a planting mood board. Now, I interview a lot of interior designers, and you know, mood boards are, you know, a good staple of getting over your vision. But you created this mood board, and you cut out load of things from like gardening catalogs, and I think you were like, I think one of your statements was like foliage and flowers, flowers and foliage, never one without the other. So you were kind of, you're constant, and I think you'd, on this mood board as well, you'd put things like height, form, texture, lushness, and clout. I love that word, clout. So do you kind of keep that as your once you've planned that, do you start that at the beginning of the year and then run with that mood board, or does it ever change?
It's just a good thing to do, I find, when you've got all this choice. And, I'm like everybody else, the seed catalogue comes in before I know it. I've circled about 45 different things, and then it comes to place the order, and you're thinking, actually, I can't grow all this. So you have to kind of just go through it, select exactly what you want, and then I find that by cutting the photos out of varieties that you haven't grown before, you see what matches. So it is exactly like doing interior design, I would imagine. And I do look back at them. It's nice to have them year on year, because that's the beautiful thing about basing your garden on an annual show. You're not really planting a show that's perennial. You're redoing it every season. So that does make it very intensive, but for me it makes it very exciting and new and fresh.
Yeah. You say you do like a spring show and a late summer show. I love how you treat it like a show. It's amazing. So describe to me the difference between the two.
So the spring show, which is happening now, is all planned from kind of down to July to December. So it's growing things like kale and ordering plants like violas and primulas, which are kind of like winter bedding, but under those are planted bulbs in the lasagna effect, which is where you have one layer of bulbs on top of the other, and that then gives you a display from, you know, this year it's been a beautiful display from early March right the way to the end of May almost. So it starts with things like crocus and hyacinths, and then it builds up towards fritillaries and tulips, and then kind of ends with alliums and emmeramis. So it's just ensuring a very long display in the spring, and then once the spring bulbs are finished in late spring, you've got all the dahlias to plant and your half-body annuals, which are cosmos, very fast-growing plants, which very quickly take the garden into a summer jungle-like dimension very quickly because they're fast-growing.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on right until the first frost in December, really.
Wow. What soil do you use for tulips? Is there any special soil that you use for these?
Yeah, I mean, it's with bulbs, it's not so much soil in pots, it's drainage. I mean, the biggest question I get asked when I'm teaching and when I put a post on Instagram seemingly is, have those pots got holes in? And the answer is yes. Every single pot I use has been drilled with holes in and has got, you know, bits of polystyrene and slate and grit, just to make sure the water goes through the pot, soaks into soil, but can escape, because that's the biggest failure with tulips and also dahlias. If they get too wet, they do literally rot in the pot.
Yeah.
And in terms of soil, I'm not buying soil every 5 minutes. I'm actually, I think like a lot of gardeners, I've become very aware of peat. So I'm looking after my soil much, much more and recycling it. And I'll just empty the whole pot when it comes to the end of spring to rejuvenate it. I'll add a bit of homemade compost, which I make at my nana's, or I'll try and find someone that allotment who's got some. It's just about rejuvenating your soil and looking after it, so encouraging worms and adding leaf mould. And if I need to buy, I have started to spend more. I'll order in wool compost from Dalesford,
uh-huh,
which is made in the Lake District. So I'm really trying to avoid, you know, going to somewhere like Wickes and buying two massive bags of compost for 10 quid. You know, we really can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
From an environmental point of view.
So, because that's new, because I literally, as we're all on lockdown, my garden, yeah. I'm looking at all my pots, and they've, you know, the soil's still in there, you know, they've all, you know, died off now, and so I'm thinking, I'm going to paint them all and do them all up anyway. So I could potentially use all that soil, mix it all in with fresh soil, or I think I've got a composting heap.
You
And can you do that straight? Yeah. Can you do you have to leave that to mix in for another year, or do you can you just refreshen it with some fresh and some feed and things like that and put it back in?
It sort of depends what you've got in your pot. So if you've got herbaceous perennials coming up and shrubs, you can actually take them out of the pot, and that won't hurt them at all. You'll just have to replant them.
Yeah.
So you can empty the whole pot, you know, go through the soil, make sure you've not got anything like vine weevil or which are the horrible little eggs that you sometimes get in pots and the grubs and eat all your roots.
Yeah.
But that's one of the nice things about having a little bit of training in horticulture. You don't quickly realise that any botanical garden or show garden that you go to, those pots that you're seeing are not just left, you know, they're constantly being taken out, potted back up. And I think as gardeners, we often think, oh, we can't move things once we've planted them. You can almost all the time. Even peonies you can move, you just have to move them in September. I would encourage anybody who gardens, whether in pots or in the ground, you know, you can move things around. It's just knowing about the right time for that right plant to be moved.
Yeah, I've got three window boxes, which are big old champagne crates, actually, and I do those every year. I remember once I brought back some bulbs from Amsterdam. I was working over there, and I planted these bulbs, and the tulips came up lovely. But literally, by the time they came up, I was itching to get rid of them so I could put my summer stuff in. Do you find that happens with you? Are you, like, itching to start your summer show?
Yeah, very much so. So actually, I try and resist commenting when I see people on Instagram doing things, because I never want to be discouraging. When I see people sowing things in, you know, early March for summer, I just think, well, if your pots are full of bulbs, I don't know what you're going to do with those seedlings. So I haven't actually sown a single thing yet, because I know that my pots are going to be still looking nice by possibly early May.
Uh-huh.
So I don't sow a single seed for summer until, you know, sometimes it can be as late as the end of May. So it's about knowing when you need to start thinking about replenishing your pots. Otherwise, you do end up with, you know, a backlog of lovely looking pots with spring bulbs in, and all your seedlings are just desperate to be planted out. So succession and knowing when to sow is quite key for a garden.
I love that, because I totally feel at the moment that obviously we're all on lockdown, and you know, people can order stuff, and everyone's like, I'm literally going to be digging up my garden and preparing my garden, and you know, and you know, turning, now I know I'd have to buy a load more soil. I can kind of turn over a few things, but I'm like going, well, I won't have had anything to put in them yet. Do you know what I mean? And actually, it's quite nice to know you probably can hold off for a little bit longer. You know, end of April,
the only seed I sow is sweet peas, and they get sown often on Boxing Day.
Uh-huh.
That's because I would have left a pot specifically empty, knowing that is for sweet peas. And sweet peas do like a long time to get their roots down, whereas, you know, summer bedding annuals, they grow so fast. I mean, a cosmos can germinate within 48 hours. And then that needs to be pricked out and potted on. So you're just creating a lot of extra work for yourself if you kind of play your garden by the, you know, the lovely big RHS handbook, because that's a handbook written, you know, presuming that you've got a large garden and cold frames, and when you haven't got that, it's almost impossible to go by those same rules.
Yeah. So where do you, like, for example, sweet peas, I love them.
Yeah.
If you haven't got a greenhouse, when is the best time to, like, put them out? How do you grow your sweet peas? Because I think I saw on your Instagram, you said you put them in the spare room. Do you have a spare room which you use as your planting room?
Well, for sweet peas are very easy, because sweet peas actually love the cold. They can't cope with the wind or too much wet, but as seedlings, they actually cope very well with the cold. So what happens is I sow about 25 of them in root trainers, which is a kit of plastic long trays which they like to send their roots down into. And I'll sow them onto the kitchen windowsill. And then as soon as each seedling is 2 inches high, they go into a tiny little lovely mini greenhouse that I love, which I think I got from IKEA, which is literally just a Perspex box. And the whole seed tray of sweet peas fits in there. They're protected from the winds, and that just keeps them really small from literally January right until now. So sweet peas, that's how I do my sweet peas. So they're not inside very long at all. The most they're inside for is about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go out. And as long as they've got some shelter from the elements, they can cope with the winter. And that stops them getting leggy and useless. So you don't want that with your sweet peas.
Yeah.
Pop them back.
But your spare room, do you, because you, Do you?
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you have a spare room for that?
My nan has, because she's confined to the below stairs really now. So her spare room at the front is currently full of crates of dahlias growing. so I use that quite a lot, and the garage as well. But again, you know, you can pot dahlias up as late as possibly May, and you'll still get a very good show. And also, some varieties grow a lot faster than others. So a lot of the varieties I like, which are the small bishops and singles and anemones, they'll be in flower for the end of June compared to the decorative ones. So it's just knowing about the habits of the plants you really like, and you learn that, you know, year on year as you grow them more and more.
So the book that you wrote, The Pottery Gardener. Is it Garden or Pottery Garden or Pottery Gardener? I'm not sure.
Gardener.
Wasn't
my choice of time.
Tell me a little bit about the book then. What was the thinking behind the book, and what do people learn if they read the book?
Well, I just kept taking photos, and eventually I ended up with all these photos, and it was quite a unique thing, what I did, the factory, you know, the setting, and it was just a constant argument against factory and garden, and I found that very unique, and I knew that it was something that was gripping people's imaginations. You know, visitors were starting to really come for the garden, and it was very different. It had a wonderful feel about it because it was literally in the middle of Stoke, which is, you know, there's not many gardens in Stoke, and it was free to enter. And the chicken element, it was very, like, farmyardy, and it was kind of my own kind of style in the garden, and it reflected very well on being a Bridgewater style as well. So I just started writing the book. I'd already started doing a few blogs online about it, and I just started writing to publishers, and the first publisher that said yes will publish it, I suggested.
Your chicken element. So where are your chickens kept? Are they in yours or your nan's?
They're also at my nan's, because chickens do like to have grass, and there's no grass at my mum's house. So yeah, they're all kept at my nan's, and they visit my mum's garden to do pest control, and to be honest, most of the photo shoots. So yeah, they come down the road with me now and again.
Oh, I had chickens for about 2.5 years, called, and my daughter named them Vanessa and Praline. We live in the centre of London, you know, and it was the best thing ever. We, you know, going down and getting the fresh eggs and things. But, you know, sadly, the foxes got them, which was devastating, especially as it was my fault, because I'd left the run open while I was in the workshop. And they got them. But they'd had a good life. They'd been with us for 2.5 years and they're doing well. What's your attachment to chickens? Like, how did that come about?
I never wanted a dog or a cat. I just honestly did want chickens ever since being little. I was lucky. My mum used to take us, you know, to the countryside, and my grandma and granddad on my mum's side, they used to take us to Derbyshire on holiday, and we'd stay on like a converted half dairy farm, half caravan site, quite near to Chatsworth. So I was exposed to the countryside in a way that a lot of my friends at school weren't being. You know, I got to see a cow giving birth, and, you know, got very used to having, you know, chickens around the caravan where we were holidaying. And it wasn't an exotic, even though I was from a town, chickens and farmyards and that kind of thing was never really an exotic thing. I always loved it, and luckily I was exposed to it despite us being a towny family. And Chatsworth House at the time, the Duchess Deborah Devonshire, she had literally 200 chickens in the public car park running around. So that was very influential, you know, going somewhere so grand and beautiful, and yet there was, you know, chickens literally as soon as you stepped out the car or trying to get your picnic. So I used to love going there, and eventually I had to wait till I was about 7 before I could keep my chickens.
So you got them quite early then? You got them quite early?
Yeah, very early. I honestly really wanted them. You know, that was the only thing that I wanted as a child. I didn't want a pony or a dog or a PS2 or whatever it was everyone was on at the time. I really wanted to have chickens.
Yeah.
I just find them very comforting animals, and they're not... I like them because it's not like having a dog where they're demanding of your attention all the time. They're quite forgiving of you going off. You know, as long as they're well looked after and are given what they need to thrive, they'll do really well for you.
So how many do you have?
I have got 12 at the moment. The numbers tend to swell about July because they all start to want to sit their own eggs. There is sometimes by, you know, August I can have as many as 40. Which gets a bit much.
Oh my god! So what do you do with them then? Like, do you how do you call them? How do you do?
So the pullets, which are the young hens of the season, they tend to find nice homes with friends. Some went to a friend last year who bought a beautiful hen house. And so the hens that are so lucky, unfortunately the cockerels aren't so lucky. We probably won't go down that road.
Yeah.
But the sad fact is when you're hatching your own chickens, there does tend to be a surplus number of male chicks. And that unfortunately is the case. No one wants cockerels, you know. Everyone's got Airbnbs now, and so they do end up going in the freezer.
Yeah. But you know what, I love that, because that's, whatever your ethical backgrounds are or whatever, we, as a family, I purposely got chickens so that my 11-year-old daughter, who's 11 now, knew where chicken came from. It didn't come from a packet in the superstore, or where our eggs come from. And we still ate chicken, even though we had chickens. And it was like, well, they're the ones that supplies you eggs, but we eat these ones. And, and I think more people should be aware of that, rather than it look like you just buy your meat from the supermarket and not know where they come from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't eat any meat from the supermarket, and I always refuse chicken if ever it's on the menu anyway.
Uh-huh.
I'm very aware of the cruelty that is inflicted on most chickens.
Yeah.
My young cockerels have a life that most chickens would only be able to dream of. They're all hatched under a hen. They're not being hatched and dropping on a conveyor belt and, being gassed alive at 4 hours old or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really difficult, and I'm very pleased that, there is a growing vegan movement, a vegetarian movement. I started off as a vegetarian when I was very little, and it was only through breeding my own chickens that I realised I'd got to start, eating these birds, because there was no way I could find them homes. And
yeah.
The fact is, if you have lots of cockerels, even in a place where you can have lots of cockerels, they literally rape the hens, they start fighting.
Uh-huh.
So there's no real ethical way of keeping, more than one cockerel in a flock of hens.
Yeah.
There seems to be an argument now that, everything should never be killed. And it's almost like we've become so desensitized from any form of farming and, animal rearing, but both sides have almost become too desensitized, I think.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I totally agree with that. You're also, you're tight on your Instagram. You always give a title of what you are, or whatever, and you say you're a florist as well. So does that come from growing your own flowers? Did you learn to do floristry that way, or was that always a passion from day one?
No, not really. What happened was the plants that I'm attracted to happen to be called flowers, and they thrive on having their flowers cut, apart from bulbs. But dahlias, cosmos, sunflowers, almost everything really, from violas and snapdragons, they all love to have their flowers cut rather than being, allowed to go to seed. They'll grow for much longer, and they'll get much more vigorous through being cut. So what happened was, I discovered Sarah Raven, who was like the first person to advocate having a cut flower garden. And then I started working for her. I was going to Perch Hill a lot, and she just encouraged me to cut flowers and, blend the colours. So I actually find doing a flower arrangement very inspirational for then doing a planting scheme, because you're like picking the whole garden within your hand almost, and you properly see how the plants and flowers, react to each other. So yeah, I was never a florist. I am definitely a florist now for Sarah, because that's my main job, is her assistant on all our photo shoots for the mail order catalogue. We're cutting out the garden all day long and arranging into vases, and then they get shot by Jonathan Buckley, who's the garden photographer.
That's amazing, because it's almost like you're working backwards. So you're starting with a flower arrangement, and then, like you say, working your way back to then deciding what you want to plant, so that you can recreate that, months down the line.
Very often we'll pick something and we'll both, me and Sarah, we'll both go, God, we've got to grow them together, to actually shoot them growing together, because they look so beautiful in the vase. It doesn't always actually work, though. So like a peony tulip quite often will look amazing as a single stem in a vase, but you wouldn't want 60 of them in the garden. They're often just too ridiculous and huge and heavy.
Yeah.
So that popular tulip, Labella Pop, which is that smoky apricot pink that was really in vogue last year, that can be a real problem in the garden in terms of its colour. It just takes away from all the colours that I love. So actually last year, the tulip show I had was a complete disaster because I went on more on what we've been picking, the photograph, than what I'd seen actually growing in a garden. So, yeah, you do have to be a bit careful.
It's good that you I think you learn more from your mistakes, don't you? That's what they say.
Yeah, you're always learning, and you never know everything either with God. Yeah. It's always surprising you, and no one ever knows the exact rule book for a garden, especially in this day and age. I mean, for God's sake, it's like June today.
Yeah.
So our gardening habits are going to have to change year on year. There's no set formula.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting, like you said, like last year's tulip display was a disaster. At what point did you go, "Ugh, it's a disaster"? And was it disheartening for you?
No, because the tulips is expensive. what happened was I'd been watching a film called The Nutcracker, and Keira Knightley was the sugar plum fairy. She's got the most beautiful dress on, and all these pinks and lilacs, and so my colour palette in my head was just drawn to all the pinky and lilac coloured tulips. The problem is often in a catalogue they're photographed at a certain stage of their flowering time, and often a tulip looks at its best just before it actually properly opens out. So what I had was literally like Covent Garden flower market by the door, only in the wrong colours. And stupidly what I'd done on the other side of the garden, on the pots on the other side, I'd done my favourite colours, which are rich red, orange and purple. So I just got a colour clash which was too close together to cope in. So that's why, you know, I just couldn't wait for them to go.
You quickly cut, like I said, you get bored quickly. Let's cut them up, let's dig them up.
Off with their heads. It does make them go, you know, when you know what you like, and when actually at home you've not got what you like.
Yeah.
It's like, oh God, I don't want to wear that, I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
So,
Keira Knightley, it's all your fault, Sugar Plum Fairy. Yes. Well, you might be able to help me. So, hydrangeas, right? My mum has these amazing hydrangeas in the garden, and she manages to get them, cut them so she can dry them. Whenever I try and do it, they just shrivel up and just look. So how do you manage to cut hydrangeas? Describe hydrangeas for me and tell me when's the best time to cut them so I can dry them.
Well, I like hydrangeas to be blushed when it gets a bit cold, so I tend to wait until round about we're getting the first light frosts, and that intensifies the colour, particularly on the nice purple, you know, the baby blue ones that then go a nice deep purple just so it gets cold. So I will cut them. I always cut them down to a pair of buds. I mean, some people say you should never cut them. I don't agree with that at all. I think it invigorates the big hydrangea bush when you're actually cutting quite substantial lengths of stem off it from the middle. So wait until you've had the first couple of frosts, and then actually put them in water. I never hang them upside down. I've never done that. Some people do. So I always put them in water, somewhere not too hot, not too cold. And sometimes if I really, really do not want them to fluff, if they're quite exquisite, I'll just put some of those, you know, you buy a new pair of shoes and there's that little packet of those, like, little see-through beads.
Yeah.
Glycerine, I think they're called. I'll add them to the water. And to be honest, they tend to dry fine for me like that, as long as they're put in water. I don't know if you've been putting yours in water.
No, I've just been hanging them upside down and then they just look like deflated. They just kind of fall apart.
So try waiting probably later in the year to pick them. I never pick a hydrangea when before it started to get cold, to be honest.
Okay.
Because whenever I've seen them at weddings or anything like that, they do tend to flop and just turn into like dead candy
floss. It's so true. One of the other things that I thought was really impressive on your Instagram, and I keep going back to your Instagram because people need to see your Instagram grid. It is beautiful. Arthur Parkinson, if you haven't been cocky, at the beginning. And you had this amaryllis green magic plant, and it was just in like a metal container, almost like, you know, a beer crate, and they were huge, but then you used silver birch twigs of silver birch to help cradle it. Are the silver birch, have you just picked them as twigs, or are they live, or what? Describe the silver birch for me and the reason for the silver birch against these huge tall amaryllis green magic plants.
So silver birch is a fast growing tree, and it sort of sees itself all over where I live, Nottingham, on all the abandoned wasteland sites and, you know, around the train lines. So anywhere that, you know, kind of like Newville disturbed earths, you will tend to find young silver birch. And in the winter, I will go and forage that by the bundle load for amaryllis, but also for the dahlias and sweet peas. So I couldn't live without silver birch. You can get it quite easily if you can't go out and forage from wildlife trusts. And a lot of the woodland trusts will be helpful in putting you in touch with someone who can let you come and forage it.
Yeah.
But the good thing about it is it doesn't root, whereas willow does root. I know everyone says, oh, can you not use willow? But the problem with willow, it almost always send out its roots in a pot, and then it just takes up all the nutrients out of the pot and will leave your dahlia or whatever completely stunted. And silver birch is very pliable, so you can literally plait it into any shape you want. You can, you just put it all the way around the inner inside of a pot and then weave it. And I've used it for years. I first saw Sarah doing it at Perch Hill. So it's a lovely thing to do in the winter. It's lovely to go and pick it and then actually do a wigwam or stake an amaryllis inside. Because amaryllis have hollow stems and they almost always fall over. And I hate to see bamboo canes and anything, especially in something like amaryllis pot indoors. It just makes it look like it's, you know, being controlled by us, and I don't ever want any of my garden to look like it's man controlled.
Now, I just love that silver birch because you did this really lovely thing where you'd got your huge dolly tubs and you'd put the silver birch, yeah, like you say, inside the pots, but all on the outside edge. And then they'd grown and gone kind of a bit wild. And then you, like plaiting a horse's mane, you plaited it into like a corkscrew, like an obliques kind of thing. So then all your sweet pea could climb through it. And that on its own, yeah, even without the sweet pea thrown in there, looked absolutely beautiful. And I was like, oh, and you did this beautiful video where you're showing how to do it and you're twisting it and it all went to the top. And I was like, I'd just be happy with that. It looked brilliant.
Have you gone and got some?
Well, no, I'm going to have to do it. I'll have a look in the garden or next door. I live with quite a few gardens back on and they're quite a bit rustic as well. So I've used big twigs and stuff to make wreaths, like door wreaths and Christmas wreaths. So I'm kind of used to that. And I love that kind of free form, kind of homemade, thrown together. I love that look. So yeah, I'm definitely going to be stealing that idea from you. Every year in spring, there's a plant that pops up. And I've mentioned this before on the podcast. It's the bleeding heart plant. And every year it dies down to nothing. And then it comes up and it just makes me smile because I kind of realise I've managed to keep something alive. And it comes back bigger and better. And this year I realised you can even cut it as well and bring it inside. And it looks just beautiful. And it sparks this joy in me. It makes me happy. Is there any one plant that or flower that has that like an emotional memory for you or that sparks joy? What plant is that?
I think I get the most joy out of seeing bees on the plants I grow now. Probably dahlias. I think dahlias are kind of the plant that keeps giving. And, you know, when you've got them on full force and full flower, you can't help but think, oh, it's good to be alive. Probably a single
dahlia
with a
bumblebee
on it.
Fab. No, I like that one. Yeah. So the last question, really, at the end of the podcast. I always ask my garden designers or gardeners to, it could be something you've already got. It could be one of the gardens you have, yours or your nan's, or it could be one you aspire to have. Can you describe to me your dream garden, what's in it, and also what you're drinking while you're in this garden?
What I'm drinking?
Yeah.
It would definitely be a gin and tonic with elderflower, with ice and borage. A lot of people think I want a big garden. I don't necessarily want a big garden. I'd love a garden with no neighbours. So I would have a very large paved area that would be full of dolly tubs and old cattle troughs. And then that would go down to an orchard, which would be planted with crab apples and my favourite, eating apples. And that's where I'd keep lots of chickens in sections of it.
So you still love the restrictions of the dolly tub. You kind of seem to thrive in
it. Yeah, I do. And at the end of the day, you know, I know I'm 27, still quite young, but, you know, when you're going to get old, we're all going to get old. I really don't I really don't want a big flower bed that I've got to dig over and, you know, lift. And so I do love pots. I mean, the only downside is the watering.
Yeah.
But everything comes with effort, so I don't see that as a downside. So no, I really do love pots, and I don't crave for a big garden either.
No.
I probably crave for privacy more. But plants do give you that. You just have to be brave with them. So
wow.
No matter where you are, you can grow plants to engulf your world.
And also, you're a huge fan of Joanna Lumley. So where did that come from? Your Instagram is covered with Joanna Lumley. What's that about?
But like chickens forever. So Joanna actually came through the post when I was very young. I just joined VIVA, which is Vegetarians International Voice for Animals, to give it its full name. And she was on the cover of this magazine about Bantry chickens and things. So I didn't know Joanna as Patsy for a long time. Then she was on James and Giant Peach as Art Spiker. And then, of course, Fab came along and told her as that. And then she started doing lots of travel documentaries, loved them. And then, eventually, I became friends with someone who was also her friend. And that way I got to start writing to her. I've met her several times. And she just makes me feel like life's worth living when I see her, you know, talking about the planet and how we should treat each other and animals. And, you know, she just stands for everything that I believe we should be craving for. And government should be craving to do for us all. So she's just full of goodness and a good person.
Yeah.
So it's not just that I like her as an actress. I do, you know, everything she stands for as a person, I agree with, and she's very beautiful and lovely.
She is.
So that's why I like Joanna.
And if you've ever listened or read her autobiography, her story as a single mum is amazing, and everything that she went through to raise her, I think it was her son. She really is an inspiring, funny, lovely lady. Arthur Parkinson, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I could keep talking to you forever, but it's been an absolute joy. I hope your granny's okay, and I know you're self-isolating with her at the moment through this tricky time, but it just means you get to concentrate more on your garden and have fun with your chickens.
Very true.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for thanks for talking to me on the TV Carpenter podcast.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
You too. It really does go to show that you can create something spectacular just by using tubs and some large pots. If you get a chance to look on his Instagram, you'll see the beautiful plants and flowers that he manages to create in his space. Oh, I hope you enjoyed listening to that. It was great fun to interview him. Don't forget, if you want that 15% discount, you can contact thorndown.co.uk and put in the code TV Carpenter and take full advantage of that and get drawing those rainbows. And who knows, someone might knock on your door and give you a colouring book as well. And I hope you're all staying safe, and I hope you're all staying well. And I just keep thinking, this is just a bit of quality time that I get to have with my girls, and, you know, it'll all turn around. Everyone's, you know, panicking about work and money and all these different things. And what's interesting is we've all got something going on, but collectively we know it's not going to last forever. And as long as we stay healthy and stay well and stay safe, we'll get through this. So hopefully we'll see everybody on the other side. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and as always, thank you for listening to me, Wayne Perry, the TV Carpenter.